Welcome to Leadershipadelics Season 2 Part 2. I'm Sebastian Fouillade. Join me every week to explore the intersection between deep spiritual experiences and leadership. Leadership in the sense of how do you manifest a better future for yourself, for your family, for your community, and for others. So join me every week as I interview guests who've had those hardships, those journeys, those hero's journeys, and they share the insights that they've gained along the way. Insights meant to inspire us, meant to awaken us, meant to help us build a better future. I've got a very special announcement. We're organizing a sacred creativity retreat in October of this year in the Sacred Valley of Peru. Now, what's a sacred creativity retreat? Well, it's all about reconnecting you with your untainted, authentic, creative selves. You know, finding that creativity from a center of alignment, finding that creativity from a center that is not tainted by the judgments of others, by the programming we've had in society. So if you're interested, check out the website retreat.fouillade.com. That's retreat.fouillade.com for more information. And I hope the stars align and I can see some of you there.
In this episode, I meet with David Wood. David has been on a mission to broaden regulated access of psychedelics. He's the chief legal officer and general counsel at Psygen, a Canadian company manufacturing pharmaceutical-grade psychedelics for clinicians and researchers. David also runs R Group Legal, where he provides legal support for a small number of operators in the cannabis industry and the psychedelic space. We talk about substance regulation for cannabis and psychedelics in Canada versus the US. We cover the special access program available for end-of-life distress for psilocybin in Canada. We cover the war on drugs and bring it all back to leadership with a bit of perspective on the Mycelium Network, a touch of Steve Jobs, Smashing Pumpkins, and Pink Floyd. Enjoy. Well, David, welcome to Leadershipadelics. Thanks for being here today. How's your day going?
Great. Really happy to be here, and thank you for having me.
Good. Well, do you have anything exciting going on today that you want to share, or a little icebreaker here?
Sure. Yeah. No, I'm actually going to one of my first in-person networking events in quite a while. It's been, besides the obvious overriding restrictions of the pandemic, it's been extremely busy for me in the last several months, and there hasn't been a lot of time for that. It's something I really miss about my work prior to the pandemic was the large amount of networking at cannabis and, to a limited extent, psychedelics focused events. And I'm really looking forward to going to another one this evening.
Oh, I bet. Like, nothing beats like the in-person meetings, like even like the those Zoom calls, you know, we've all gotten used to them. It's like you lose so much in there, like all the little, you know, body language and everything. And just like it's funny because I'm like, as much as I like the convenience of it, it's like I'm really tired of the Zoom calls. It's like I want those in-person interactions.
Well, and if you were right here in Calgary, I'd be able to share regulated cannabis products with you. Can't do that over Zoom.
There you go. That's awesome. And I do plan on, you know, I need to have a trip up north and down south. So those are the ones I'm planning for this summer. So I want to take the podcast on the road. But enough about that. So what are, like, quickly, what are some of those projects that you're working on right now?
Yeah, no, thank you. So I work primarily in two avenues. One is as the chief legal officer and general counsel at Psygen Industries Limited, and the other is running my own legal practice, which is entirely focused on intellectual property and regulatory law in cannabis and psychedelics. And of course, with the psychedelics work, I try and steer clear of any competitors or potential overlap with Psygen. And so far that has gone very well. The Psygen part is the easiest for me to speak about, and I'll keep it focused on that. But we've been busy. There's a lot happening. We're very excited that just over two weeks ago, psilocybin was used through Canada's Special Access Program for the first time in history, and it was Psygen material that was provided for that. And again, we're extremely proud that that happened, and we're happy to have been able to donate GMP synthetic psilocybin for use in a patient, well, and several patients who had end-of-life distress and similar conditions for which, as you know, there's a lot of evidence that in combination with psychotherapy, psilocybin has a lot of efficacy for. And it's a particularly, I'd say, you know, my job day to day, I'm a lawyer that deals with intellectual property and regulatory points. It doesn't get emotional a lot. But when I was reading, I guess just backing up a bit, before PsyGen supplied this material, I was actually working pro bono with the physician as well through my legal practice to help the special access request move forward. And initially, PsyGen was not the planned source. But when the first choice was no longer an option, I, you know, declared a conflict of interest, of course, and then suggested that the physician use PsyGen product, and she agreed. And so we're very happy to have it work out that way. I mean, the main thing was to get the patients what they needed, and the fact that we were able to supply it from our material was, you know, something that made everyone at PsyGen very happy. So that was about 2 weeks ago, and there's been some ripple effects because of that. The special access program was only opened up to psychedelics on January 5th. So we were really happy that the first use in a patient occurred just under 3 months after it became a legal possibility. And I even had the good fortune to speak with one of the patients. And I have to say that, when I went into law school, I never thought there'd be a moment where I'd sit down with the CEO of the company I work at and listen to a man describe the psilocybin that we had provided him with and how it differed from eating mushrooms that have psilocybin in them. Because this material, again, was pure, over 99% pure active pharmaceutical ingredient that's just psilocybin. So, you know, I don't know much about this firsthand, but I would suspect that much like we saw with cannabis, one isolated active is going to feel different and do a different thing and have a different onset pace than a bouquet of chemicals, where in cannabis you have hundreds. With psilocybin mushrooms, it's my personal view is that it's probably not hundreds. It's probably a more modest entourage effect, but probably there nonetheless. And I've heard people tell me that psilocybe cyanosis are different than cubensis. And so there is something there, but what we supply is pure compound, and it definitely helped the patient. And we're very happy to hear that. And it's important because my understanding is that when one is suffering from end of life distress, it can really rob one of the time that is left, you know, with depression and feeling awful. So if the psilocybin and the psychotherapy, which was delivered in a group context, helps these people, you make better use of the time they have remaining, then, you know, that for me is a very meaningful and important aspect of the work we're doing, because mental health is an issue. And the trend over the last few years, certainly accelerated in the last 2 years, is that it's a problem of greater and greater magnitude all the time. So we need treatment options that are actually effective, that do more than suppress symptoms. And I think we're seeing that with MDMA and psilocybin. I predict we'll also see it with LSD, DMT, and a bunch of other chemicals. And it's just wonderful to be working in an area that's so impactful on people's mental health and also so close to my own personal interests.
Great. That's wonderful. And for that patient, what are some of the highlights that came out of this? Like, had he tried like normal mushrooms before? It sounded like he did, and then compared it to, you know, that pure, 99% pure, psilocybin.
Yes.
And like, what were some of the highlights, like the experience itself? Like, did he get the same benefit, more benefits? Like, was the session the same length? Like, how did that, I don't know what you can disclose because you're probably still sorting through that data and it's still research at the same time. So,
yeah. And I don't want to share too much of his personal comments, but And it's over 99% pure. I'm actually a little embarrassed. I don't know how far past 99 it goes, but it's, I believe it's over 99.9, but don't take that to the bank. I'd have to check the certificate of analysis. But, he did say he had, so this gentleman had actually received a subsection 56.1 exemption to possess and use psilocybin. And he received that exemption in August of 2020. Through work with a nonprofit called Theracil. Theracil helps Canadians get access to psilocybin for medical use. And they made history when in August of 2020, they helped manage the first four patients to receive exemptions to possess and use psilocybin for medical purposes. Now, I'm saying those words very carefully because a lot of people say that those patients had access. In my view, they didn't. The thing that just happened 2 weeks ago was access. That was a regulated source providing well-defined, characterized, regulated products to a patient through a federally administered system. The exemptions that were issued just under 2 years ago and since then, those are different because all they do is exempt the individual from the prohibition on possession, and they authorize consumption. It's interesting. In Canada, it's not a crime to consume a drug. It's a crime to possess a drug unless you have an exemption. And and it's not – and I don't like the word crime. It is a contravention of the CDSA. Yeah. The CDSA is the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act. I'll use the abbreviated term because that's a lot of syllables. But under the CDSA, like in most countries, including the United States, possession of a controlled substance is prohibited, subject to authorizations. Psygen, where I work, is a licensed dealer, which means we are authorized to possess and manufacture psilocybin, psilocin, MDMA, LSD, DMT, mescaline, and 2CB. We are also working with other compounds that are not scheduled in Canada. Whether or not they're scheduled in the countries they're headed for, they're not scheduled here. So while we still have to make them to a high production standard, we do not have to comply with the CDSA to do so, as they're simply not controlled. A good example of that would be 5-methoxydimethyltryptamine is a substance in Canada is just not controlled, but is known for its psychedelic properties and probably used by a large number of people. So in any event, the special access program allows a regulated source to reach a patient. These exemptions, on the other hand, were only authorized the patient to possess. They did not. And depending on how narrowly one views the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act and its application, cannot provide access. And if you want to think, I'll use US terms here. In Canada, we have two regulators. One of them is called the Office of Controlled Substances. In the United States, you would call them the DEA, right? In Canada, the other office that's relevant here is the Therapeutic Products Directorate, which you would call the FDA. So one body says you're not allowed to have controlled substances unless we say so, and we decide. We're the OCS in the US, the DEA. We decide who's allowed to work with controlled substances and under what circumstances. The other body, and they have nothing to do with each other. That's not true. They're independent of each other. They do work together, of course. The other body says we regulate therapeutic products. Therapeutic products would include primarily drugs, medical devices, and natural health products. And we say what's authorized and what isn't. So just like I can't sell mushrooms to people because I would contravene the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act, I would also be contravening the Food and Drugs Act because I'd be selling a drug without an authorization. If I were to sell 5-methoxy-DMT to someone, outside of any authorization, that would contravene the Food and Drugs Act, but not contravene the CDSA. So when people have these exemptions, they're allowed to possess, but they have nowhere to get the material, which means they have to source it from an illicit source, which carries risk. So I'm really happy that the SAP special access program now allows psychedelics to be accessed in Canada for medical use. And I'm very happy that it's only 3 months after that became a possibility that the first use in patients occurred. So big progress. In all the Health Canada communications on this point, they really emphasize psilocybin and MDMA because those are the two drugs that there's the most clinical data for. We all know who the companies bringing them to market are. But it applies equally to all drugs that are restricted drugs. In Canada, a restricted drug is like your Schedule One. So that was an extremely long way to say what we've been up to lately, but it's a big event. We really are proud of, you know, supplying this and happy it happened.
Yeah, this is great. And then in Canada, do you also have kind of what we have in the US, like that with the state level ability to override or come up with their own laws and bills, or is it all like federal regulated in Canada?
That's a great question. So Canada is inverted relative to the US in that our federal government has much more ability to override provincial governments where it has jurisdiction to do so. And controlled so in Canada, we have one criminal code for the country. And don't forget, Canada has a little under 40 million people in it. We're geographically comparable to the US, but in population size, we're, I mean, barely California. And that's only California. If you just count the people that actually, you know, are there on paper. I'm sure the actual population of California much higher. So because of that, there's less need for things like death penalty in one province, but not in another. And controlled substances are identical. And cannabis, which in Canada is not in any way a controlled substance, which is awesome, is similarly regulated at the federal level. So the stuff on this box, the warning label, the THC and CBD, and in this case, CBG percentages, that's all federally regulated. And drug products are the same. And by the way, when I hold this stuff up, I have no connection to these companies. This is just what's on my desk. In Canada, those products I just showed you, those would be uniform across the country. However, the way they're sold is different in every province. I live in Alberta. We have, I can safely say, the best cannabis retail system in the world right now. It's fantastic. I live in a very suburban part of Calgary, which puts me in good running for most suburban part of Canada. And there are at least five cannabis stores within a 10-minute drive. And two within a 15-minute walk of where I am right now in my home, which is amazing.
Is that another body that's controlling the retail system that's at the province level?
Correct. So the analogy to psychedelics would be very similar. A controlled substance is nationally a controlled substance. There are two municipalities in Canada, Vancouver and Toronto, that have applied for subsection 56.1 exemptions to remove the prohibition on possession within their municipal boundaries. I am not aware of where those applications are at, whether they have a realistic chance of issuing, but if they did issue, then that would be the federal government, our version of the DEA, the Office of Controlled Substances, would be saying, hey, Canadians, non-Canadians, whoever's there, if you happen to be within this geographical region, possession of, maybe it's all controlled substances, maybe it's certain ones, I don't know, is no longer criminally prohibited. That would not authorize transacting in them. Trafficking would still be prohibited. But within whatever the limits of the exemption are, possession would not be. Kind of like what you have in the city of Denver and a few other cities with psilocybin, and I think with some American cities with other Seattle substances too. So that's how the federal government regulates controlled substances in Canada. In terms of how those substances are accessed for a therapeutic purpose at the product level, and I have no controlled substance products to show you because I don't have any, at the product level, those would be regulated federally. In terms of possession, et cetera, it's the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act. Okay. And then in terms of putting something in a box and making it compliant, that would be also federal, but that would be the Therapeutic Products Directorate. Like amphetamine is a prescription drug in Canada. Morphine, prescription drug in Canada. So is ketamine. Each of those is a controlled substance. I think all three of them are narcotics, actually. No, amphetamines are controlled drugs. The other two are narcotics. But the point is, those would be regulated at the federal level as products. At the provincial level, we might have different rules in Alberta than in Quebec for how physicians are allowed to prescribe ketamine, right? And ketamine's a good example there as kind of a cutting edge, because it's being used off-label a ton. Racemic ketamine, left and right-handed ketamine, is being used off-label a ton in Canada for depression. And left-handed ketamine only, Spravato, is being used on-label for treatment of, I believe, depression, whatever the monograph says. So that practice is regulated federally at the product level, but provincially at the healthcare provider level, like the physicians, the nurses, the others that are involved in providing the care are regulated provincially. So the limits of what they can and can't prescribe and on what basis they can prescribe it while remaining in ethical compliance with their obligations, that would be provincial. And I don't know this, but I wouldn't be surprised. Different provincial bodies have taken different positions on ketamine. And I wouldn't be surprised if, much like in the psychedelic space as a whole, that's sort of a ramp up to what we're going to see with MDMA first and then likely psilocybin second.
That's fascinating. I listened to all this. I'm like, oh my God, there's like so many pieces to align in that supply chain in order to get them from, you know, the creator of the drug to the consumer. Every step of the way at multiple levels. And, you know, I was just listening to, I think it's John Dennis, working on 109 in Oregon, and the amount of work that goes in those laws just for one state, and all the considerations that go into it, and all the potential conflict of interest and like navigating all this. I'm like, wow, I'm glad there are people working on that, spending their time on this. Like, I'm actually going to go visit John, so that will be a different visit, not the same one. I go visit you because he's in Eastern Oregon, but go visit him to learn more about that, because it's fascinating. And having people who spend the time to understand all this is important. Yes. Like reading the actual bills, reading the actual, you know, understanding the importance of community, you know, like what patients need, because unleashing also some of those substances without any checks and balances is also would kind of blow back on our faces.
Well, we have seen negative publicity on that point recently, and it has to be mitigated. I mean, these are substances that increase vulnerability, to say the least, and you're doing this in a at-risk population, people with mental health issues, although I really believe that as this goes full circle, much like other cognitive therapy, it's my belief and my hope that at some point MDMA-supported psychotherapy or psilocybin-supported psychotherapy or others becomes elective. Like I really, because again, when you think about the potential harms, I'm sure that there are other drugs that people use electively that are probably more harmful, where there's buy-in from regulators on their use in that context. I think that as attitudes mature and as we drop some social baggage, I mean, I'm old enough to remember the Soviet Union. I remember Just Say No. It's a very effective media campaign. It's stuck in my mind forever. And it'll take a while for the population at large to realize that while drugs definitely pose risks, and to quote the UN, there are risks of social and economic harms associated with their use, and there is a right and a wrong way to mitigate that. Maybe total prohibition, besides being ineffective, delivered an inconsistent and inapplicable message. And I think we did suffer a bit of a loss there, because I think the right amount of psychedelics in someone's life, in most cases, is not going to be zero. And, but then should it be available at every gas station? No questions asked. Probably not. Neither should a gun, right? Or a firearm, I should say. You know, it's just, we have created technologies that require responsible use. LSD is one of those technologies. MDMA is one of those technologies. And then there's natural substances like ayahuasca and psilocybin mushrooms that overlap with these. And I do believe that there should be some form of regulation that covers that. But I do not believe that absolute prohibition is the correct way to do it. But that's and I'm thrilled that as a lawyer, not a criminal lawyer, an intellectual property and regulatory lawyer, that this is so connected to my work now. Like it's a sign of how far things have come. And it's wonderful that we get to wear shirts like the ones we're wearing at work more openly.
Oh, wonderful. Well, this is a great way to shift to your journey. I was actually going to pull a card first, but we're going to, before we do that, before we shift to your journey, I'm going to pull a card. And I've started doing this with guests on the podcast, and it's from a deck called the Earth Magic deck. So if people are watching, I'm flashing the Earth Magic deck here. And it's something that is done sometimes before ceremonies or after ceremonies. And it's a great way to reflect on things. And it's sometimes the synchronicity on those cards is pretty amazing. It's like, oh my God, like, I was just thinking about that. And it really opens people for conversation. So I started doing that on the show. I did ask you before the show if you wanted to do that, so not to scare future guests. Like, you know, it's like I don't surprise people with this. But you know, I'll pull the card and you know the there's a little ritual. You actually, you know, my wife likes to do that. She taught me to, like, you tap three times on the cards, and you know, if you believe in angels or greater power, you ask questions. You can ask a question if you want. I would just ask, you know, can you give me any message on David's journey, or if you have something more specific?
No, let's go with the general.
So, yeah. So I just, you know, usually it's very simple. You just shuffle the cards. And eventually your shuffling is kind of a random, and some card just pops out. I had one earlier. Oh, and there's your, ooh. Well, there you go. So this card is perspective.
Perfect.
Exactly. It usually is. This is also a little experiment that I'm doing, you know, on the podcast, and it shows the Milky Way and perspective. So how does that relate to you and your journey?
Well, I think probably remembering that you can't relate to where you are if you don't think about where you're from. We're all from the Milky Way. I believe I'm not inaccurate there. That's the galaxy we live in. And well, it's been a while. And Syd Barrett has a song called Milky Way. And like most of his Pink Floyd work, it's post-Pink Floyd work. It's not very good, but it is out there. I'd just say that perspective, I mean, it's wrapped up in everything I do. The whole reason I'm working with controlled substances is to help people gain perspective. And I'd say that in at least two ways. One is the products that SciGen manufactures and that are used in clinical trials. That's what they do. They affect people's perspective and hopefully help them, whether it's through the actual per se neurochemistry or what they're witnessing and what they're able to accept about themselves and their past and about people involved in their past, helps them get the perspective to move beyond trauma and you know, keep progressing through their lives rather than being stuck somewhere, as we see with PTSD. So that's a very direct way perspective is relevant to what I do. And in a broader way, much like we're doing right now, I think it's helping people who are good people who've never really, you know, who follow the rules, who have never really had any exposure to psychedelic drugs, because for the most part, the ones they've heard of are controlled substances. So, of course, they wouldn't be around them or be around people who possess or use them. And the ones that are not controlled, they've definitely never heard of because they've never given it a second thought. Those are some of my favorite people to talk to because I like to help them understand that whether they paid attention or not, there's significant misinformation in the messaging they've gotten over the decades. And that probably before their time on Earth ends, it's probably worth at least reading a little bit about what psychedelics are, how they're used traditionally. And I think ayahuasca, bogaine, and psilocybin mushrooms, and whatever was in the Kaikion, let's not leave Europe out of it, is part of who we are. And regardless of what laws may be where they are, and of course, I'd never recommend anyone break the law ever. You know, the laws aren't the same everywhere in the world. And maybe going to Peru and exploring this side of the human experience is something that's a good idea for them. Or maybe even at a church that's authorized to do the same thing in the country they live. Like, because criminal use of psychedelics is criminal. Criminal is a conclusion only a judge can come to, but use in contravention of legislation like the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act carries some risk, carries risk in that you may have uncertainty about the safety or the quantity of the product you're buying, particularly with synthetics. You don't want to get dragonfly. If you think you're buying 2CB fly, you'll probably end up dead. So there's that. And then there's also the legal risk. I mean, if something happens and law enforcement's involved, you know, could go really badly. But subject to all that lawyerly disclaimers, I'd say that this is a side of existence that we've kind of been denied. And I'm not going to quote him directly, but whatever it was Steve Jobs said about LSD, what was a surprising thing to be said by, you know, a guy that didn't peak in high school. Like, he was accomplished. He did whatever he wanted for a large part of his life. I mean, maybe you've met him. I don't know. But
I haven't. But, you know, I've read his book and I can quote him. I mean, he said if Bill Gates had done more LSD or gone to an ashram, he would be a broader guy. And I think Microsoft would have been a different company. And I worked there for 10 years. So this was actually one of the things that compelled me to start the podcast, is those experiences, those psychedelic experiences, have influenced our society already. And how we're, you know, whether it's through music, whether it's through technology, whether it's through science. And, you know, because people were in the closet and not talking about it, it's very easy to assume that it hasn't happened, but it has happened. Like, where we are today has been heavily influenced already by psychedelics. Now, could we have been in a better place if, you know, Nixon didn't decide to go after his enemies by starting the war on drugs, which is, you know, what I heard yesterday on some of the podcasts? Was like, it was really started for him to go after his political enemies. And I was like, oh, wow, that's interesting. I didn't know that. But like, as you peel the onion and learn more about the history and how we got there, you're like, oh, wow. Like, everything I believed as a kid growing up during the war on drugs, you know, trying to be good. And you know, of course, being growing up in a Catholic family, you also have the fear of God's wrath as well. So you combine those two together and you're like, I believe what they're telling me, you know, and eventually, like, you need to wake up. I mean, for me, it was working with Native Americans through the Native American church here, which was, you know, which is legal way to do a ceremony with ayahuasca or peyote. And that was very transformative. My wife went down to Peru and worked with Shipibo maestros, and that was also very transformative. So it's not affordable to everyone. Not, you know, everyone can find a Native American church or fly down to Peru. And I think that's why all the work that's happening right now is so important. Is, you know, we have the opportunity, if we nudge things the right way, to do some good for humanity, when we kind of need this pretty bad now, if you just
that's my personal belief as well. Yes. And one, Oregon, and now I'm not really following which U.S. states are setting, like, I know there's a lot of states that are considering decriminalization of certain substances, and I know Oregon is setting up a per se regulated system for sale of psilocybin. I think other states are leaning in that direction. I don't know that. But regardless of, and who knows, by the, like, today it's April 14th. I don't know when this publishes, and I don't know how much has changed by then. And by the way, I hope I hope, that dozens more of special access program requests have been issued by then. We'll see, but that's my hope. But it's I agree with you. That is something that is needed, in my personal opinion, you know, in compliance with the law, of course. And I think that the conversation being destigmatized, we've come a long way there. Like, it's very fashionable to talk about microdosing psilocybin or to talk about using MDMA. I think we still have some baggage with LSD. That's the one I try and destigmatize as much as possible. We got that right here on, but not in my coffee cup. Yes. But I think the more you help people and people like Joe Rogan, with the and Tim Ferriss, in addition to Steve Jobs, like these high performing, successful people who are kind of behind use of psychedelics as a practice, or at least the statements they make are consistent with that, help people realize, well, maybe this isn't just an escape that diminishes me and that is entirely frivolous. Maybe there is something here. And that gets into your own experience of what's behind your eyes and cognitive liberty. And I think that if you believe an experience has merit, then it does. I mean, I might not believe that, but that's me. Other people will value different things. And psychedelics is one side of that. Immersive interaction with digital media would be another. Like some people would say that a virtual existence has as much merit as a physical one. That's not my belief, but maybe that's just because I'm old. But, you know.
It's not mine either, but that's because I love nature.
Yes.
No, that's good. So when did your kind of spiritual awakening start and happen in your journey?
Well, I mean, again, I'm as of this recording, I'm 43 years old. I'm turning 44 soon. I remember Chernobyl. I remember Challenger. I was at Expo 86. I don't know why I focused on that year so much there, but I didn't even think about any drug, and I considered them all equivalent. I mean, I considered cannabis and heroin and LSD to all be the same thing, all bad. I had just never met anyone that was worth talking to who used drugs until I was 18. And that person was in my wedding party and I was in his. He's one of my best friends, Ben and Sean, you know who you are. But anyway, the point, and I'm talking about two people at once there who are both kind of early examples in my life of people who, you know, were more open to this, and this being, you know, cannabis and psychedelics. And they weren't losers. They weren't people that were going nowhere fast. They were good people. They were people with values. They were people with integrity. They worked hard. And at the age of 18 in 1996, I didn't know you could work hard and use cannabis. Like, it just didn't line up to me. It didn't make any sense. So that would be it. And you know, my personal contact with psilocybin and LSD was around the same time, you know, meeting people that were open to this. And again, just being alarmed at how they didn't behave like a bunch of drunks, which is basically what I expected at the time, you know, was alarming to me. And when I realized that what these substances do and what they show you is not to be lumped in with what other drugs of abuse, and I hate the term drugs of abuse, and I hate that other, but you know what I mean? What they're the war on drugs really lumped a bunch of substances together that have very, very little to do with each other, other than the fact that they're all contravened, or sorry, they're all prohibited, and they all put you off baseline, but in very different ways and with very different sets of consequences. And I'll always believe that one of the most destructive aspects of drug prohibition was how it made cannabis equivalent to substances that have far, far more severe consequences. Because if you learn that you can't trust the messaging on this one, pre-internet, unable to research, unable to really access good information, maybe you'll assume that the consequences of using this every day are the same as the consequence of using opiates every day, right? Yeah, they lied to you about one. Why wouldn't they lie to you about all of them? And that, I know, broke a lot of lives, and that's a tragedy. And it's it was a big misstep by our respective governments, and one that I'm glad is sort of turning around now.
Slowly. I mean, it's hard to, you know, I think for us who are in the industry, we see it moving around a lot faster because we see it from the industry. Looking around, like taking a step out, you know, looking at people like my mom and other people that's like older generation, it's really hard for them to kind of change that state of mind. Because my mom still think, you know, psychedelics are addictive, that I'm going to end up in some dark alley somewhere.
Any day now.
Yeah. And she's probably going to listen to this. So it's like, hey, mom. But it's true. And so, you know, they're not. Like, that's the thing. It's like, I don't see people like going to an ayahuasca ceremony or doing three ceremonies in a row and saying, hey, when is the next one?
Yeah, I want to live my whole life this way.
It's like, it doesn't work this way. It's like, you I mean, there's, you know, that's the other thing I want to touch on, and you're probably going to touch on, but the psychedelics are just the substance. Like, it's what you do with it.
Yeah.
It's a spectrum. There's so much. And what's interesting with the psychedelic industry, it's because we call it the psychedelic industry, we name it after the substance, not necessarily the modality in which it's being used.
I want to address that quickly because I resist calling it an industry. This is an industry. Cannabis is an industry. But it's a consumer package good, you know, you need lots of these things. You got to buy them and consume them, and you buy them whenever you feel like.
So for people who are watching, who are not watching and listening, David is showing me a nice
couple of pre-rolls from British Columbia, and that I bought here in Alberta. And you know, that I paid excise duty on. If you're watching, that is duty stamp. Yeah.
There's plenty here too.
Yeah. But taxes. The point is, like, that's an industry. Cannabis is a consumer packaged good. It has a heterogeneous commodity, but it's still a commoditized input with a very low value at this point, especially in Canada. It's an industry. It's got its own rules. I don't have it here to hold up, but I could show you how thick the cannabis regulations are. They're thick, 350 pages plus 150 pages of the Act for one of the most tightly regulated products in Canada, with good reason. But that's an industry. To me, psychedelics, they're a substance that disrupts two things for now. Might disrupt more. But for now, they're very disruptive to mental health care, right? Yeah. And they're disruptive to the pharmaceutical industry that supplies drugs for mental health care. Those are two different things. Yeah, the pharmaceutical industry.
Those are industries.
Yeah. Well, the pharmaceutical industry sells products. Some of those products there will be competition from psychedelics as products. That just makes sense. The other side, though, and I think the much more significant side here, and also a great decentralization of control, is psychedelics, first and foremost, at least now, the way they're used therapeutically involves psychotherapy. And that means psychotherapists, psychiatrists, and other healthcare practitioners who are human beings who live in a community and work there have to deliver a bunch of the services. So to me, when you think about dollars spent per patient with SSRIs, the majority of the pie chart is going to be on drugs that are sold to a person and they come from a company. And there's going to be some psychotherapy there, but probably most of the spend is on drugs.
Yeah.
And I'm not criticizing the approach at all. Like, it is what it is.
No, but you're changing the business model with psychedelics as well.
With psychedelics, I think most of the money spent is on psychotherapy. And I mean, you've probably visited some of these ketamine clinics like I have. They're beautiful. They have beautiful.
I haven't visited them, but I've had several guests talking about them. they can be beautiful, but I think some of them are also trying to find their space. And, you know, there's one guest, I'll send you that article later, but sure. He wrote about one of his experiences, and it wasn't positive. It was basically, he went in there, the therapist wasn't trained. I mean, they didn't have a therapist on staff. He basically got hooked up to a drip, played whatever music he wanted to play. And you know, they just made sure he didn't have any bad, physical
toxicological responses.
It.
Yeah,
exactly. But that was it. He was kind of left hanging. And I had another guest, Rob, Kalvarovsky, on the show, and he talked about his experience, but he also said that a lot of the work he's done before from a mental health perspective with therapy, and helped him in his own experience. So like all of those, I think even things like ketamine therapy, we're still working on improving that and finding the right way to do it. And there's some bad, there's going to be some bad players too, that we have to, you know, like in any, you know, anytime there's the potential of making money, I think you're going to get some bad players. So.
Yeah, absolutely. One, and also where everyone does everything right, but it just doesn't work out. That's going to happen. Like to think that's the other thing. I don't think psychedelics are a panacea, and I don't think they're without risk. Alexander Shulgin knew a lot about drugs, and I'm paraphrasing, but I think he said something like, "There is no such thing as a safe drug." And I agree with him. There's risks that can be mitigated, and they can be mitigated intelligently, maybe by knowing how much you're taking and not taking it right before a Smashing Pumpkins concert when you're 18. But by the way, when I was 18,
personal experience.
Well, I won't comment on that. But when I was 18, their double album had come out, but they hadn't ruined themselves with Ava Adore yet. So they were kind of perfect. It was the fall of 1996 was the best time to see the Smashing Pumpkins. Yeah. But anyway, all that to say, you can mitigate risk with good practice, with good clinical practice, built on top of good manufacturing practices for the substances. And I'm not denigrating people that want to use botanical products at all, because first, maybe for botanical products, a different standard applies. This is not a GMP product. This is a GPP product.
Again, David different is slashing standard. Me with his, you know, good products from.
Yes, yeah, sorry for people listening. My point is, for synthetic pharmaceuticals, just like with natural health products, good manufacturing practices or GMP are important to know that the product is safe and that it is what it says it is. In Canada, and this is a uniquely Canadian thing, cannabis products are manufactured to a different standard, and it is called good production practices. And I think the word production is there rather than manufacturing, in recognition of cannabis can be a primarily agricultural product, or it can be a tablet with THC in it, and the THC came from a microorganism. Like it doesn't necessarily need to be from a plant, at least not in Canada. Yeah. And so they apply a different production standard. It's not more stringent. I guess it is less stringent than GMP, but it more importantly, it's just different. And it's more reflective of the fact that you're dealing with a substance that has an active, and you have to know how much of the active is there. But beyond that, the requirements are quite a bit less granular and less detail oriented than they are with pharmaceuticals, and with good reason. Yeah. I mean, psychedelic drugs are in some ways a relatively safe pharmaceutical, because the therapeutic to lethal dose is going to be, you know, orders like, think about LSD. I mean, you have to take tens of thousands of doses probably. Well, I don't know. I don't know lethal dose, but it's very high compared to one psychoactive dose. And so with psychedelics, you're talking about drugs that in general are quite a bit safer than other drugs that save people's lives, like chemotherapy drugs. You get that wrong, you could kill somebody, right? That's why you need a lot of well-characterized products to use them at all. I think with psilocybin mushrooms, maybe you don't have to be that precise. Maybe just knowing it's free of mold knowing how much psilocybin, and I'd say how much psilocin was there the day you packaged it, maybe that's enough, right?
Yeah, no, that's interesting. And I was listening to another podcast where, again, that's the John Dennis podcast. He made a good point that in some traditions, not having an accurate dosage is part of the tradition, part of getting the mushrooms. You know, it's not, you know, Western science where you need a, you know, like perfect accuracy on everything. Is you're taking the plant as it is, and this is part of the ritual.
Yeah.
And so allowing for that protection, that was under religious and community type of protection they're working on, is also important. So, you know, everything has its place depending on the context in which you want to use. But if it's Western medicine, you need that accuracy because you're trying to scale that to, you know, millions of people and have results when you can expect.
Perhaps using it intravenously or intramuscularly, yeah. Perhaps using it where, you know, like with Ibogaine, I think we want to be pretty clear on dosages people are taking.
Oh, yeah.
Right? You know, but then when you go outside of that, like that's where psychedelics are so fascinating because, as you observed, they have a therapeutic application and those therapeutic applications are diverse. There's the psychotherapy part, which I think will always be most of it.
Yeah.
But there are studies on whether or not LSD can mitigate the impact of neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's, yeah. Right? Like that has nothing to do with psychotherapy or understanding the root of your trauma. That's just neurochemistry. It could be that some of these molecules help correct pathologies. But then outside of that, they're the foundation of some religions. And that's, it's just interesting. I have something so pharmaceutically relevant, so potent, and I mean potency in its true sense, the way LSD is potent and Ibogaine is not, as in number of molecules to get an effect. You have something that's so powerful, let's say, in terms of what it can do to your perception of reality and your interaction with your environment, with other people, to the extent you consider other people different than the environment. We want to start talking about ego dissolution, but it's interesting how they're pharmacologically relevant and therapeutically relevant, but there's also something so connected to what makes humans human about psychedelics that can't be overlooked. And that's why there are religious exemptions to use them. Yeah. And I don't know why we'd have any trepidation about enthusiastically exploring the limits of those types of authorizations, because it's a valid question, especially now as society continues to evolve. We have all these norms that are being challenged. I mean, I don't know why. I'll say it this way too. I have worked a little bit with First Nations in Canada. You know, people that were here before Europeans. Yeah. The correct word in my mind is First Nations. In Canada, we have a piece of legislation called the Indian Act. I wouldn't describe myself as excessively woke, but I think that should probably be changed. But anyway, that's what the act is called. But when I'm talking to First Nations, one of them raised a really interesting point with me. And that was, you know, traditionally, they may have hunted with bows and arrows, and they may have moved around by just walking because there were no horses. But then practices evolved, right? And they started hunting with gunpowder operated weapons. They started hunting with horses. They started hunting with cars. Who's to say MDMA is any less relevant to what they're doing than mescaline? Right. I know my answer, they're to say, right.
Yeah.
Not our drug laws. So if they have a historical practice of healing their community, maybe healing individuals, but let's say maintaining their community's health through these practices. And I don't understand them. I don't want to, that'd be condescending of me to say that I understand, but that's my understanding level of them, is that they keep the community healthy through practices. I don't know why you'd say, well, it has to be peyote, it has to be ayahuasca, it has to be psilocybin, because that's what you had before. If they're going to hunt with rifles under the same rights that they hunted with bows and arrows, then why can't they use LSD or MDMA under the same rights that they could use mescaline or psilocybin? And maybe there are good reasons they can't. I don't know. But
who's worried about them and why? What's the motivation to say you can't or you can? That becomes interesting. You know, like, is it real concern for people's health and well-being, or is it something else? Or is it just the status quo of like, well, you know, that's the way we've been doing things. We've been saying no to everything. So it's easier to say no than to actually try to change the rules.
And is there a better way to mitigate the social and economic harms? Again, to quote the UN conventions that all these laws stem from, is there a better way than straight up prohibition? And in Canada, with cannabis at least, we think there is a better way. You regulate it, you tax it, and you employ people that are complying with the law instead of enriching those that aren't.
Yeah. No, good. We have a little bit of time left.
It's to talk about leadership?
to talk about, well, you and leadership. I mean, one of the things I wanted to touch on that, you know, when we first met, I think it was like, I don't know, it feels like almost a year ago.
Yeah.
But like, I really like that you also challenged the stigma associated with those early on in your work. And can you expand a little bit on that and share some of those stories? Because I love, you know, that part of your journey. And I thought it was very inspiring.
Well, I also loved it. So I've been practicing law for 13 years. I started my career at the largest and one of the best law firms in Canada, Borden Ladner Gervais. Great place to be from. And for a lot of my former colleagues, a great place to continue and to carry out their entire career. Like, it is an excellent law firm. And I worked there for 12 years. And about partway through that, in 2016, I got medical cannabis access, which was wonderful. And I am kicking myself now for not having a vintage pre-Cannabis Act container to show you. But if we do this again, I will have one. I'll show you the very first regulated cannabis product container I opened, because I definitely kept that one. But the point was, in June of 2016, I received a package in the mail, and that package had cannabis in it that I bought from a company called Aurora. And it was shipped from about an hour and a half from my home. And I could not believe this was really happening. I thought this was only for Colorado. But I should say California, because it was medical. But what that meant was that I was now allowed to have cannabis. And that meant I was allowed to use cannabis. And the law is different now. But at the time, there weren't really laws specifically about smoking cannabis in public. You weren't allowed to possess it, which meant you weren't allowed to smoke it. But if you were allowed to possess it, there were no specific laws on where and when you can or can't use it. So I exercised discretion, and I would not use it unless people were allowed to smoke cigarettes in the location I was in. But in my mind, that included immediately before a firm dinner, when my friends were enjoying their pre-dinner cocktails, which I've never been a huge fan of, I would enjoy my pre-dinner medical cannabis. That was greeted with, let's say, alarm and consternation by some of my colleagues who could not believe what I was doing right in front of them, just outside a restaurant where you are allowed under municipal law to smoke cigarettes. I want to be very clear about that.
While they were sipping one cocktail after another?
Yes. Well, they were outside smoking cigarettes. I wasn't in the restaurant, but yes, they were a couple drinks deep, and they were surprised with my brashness at just lighting a joint right before dinner, wearing my nice dinner clothes, going to smell like weed now. And I explained to them that I have a medical access card, and I still carry it, actually, for purely nostalgic reasons. It has since expired, but that is an Aurora MMPR card. And I guess I just showed your viewers my birthday.
Edit that out.
Edit out the number, please. But that's what the card looks like.
If you want to see the card, the card is on screen, though it will be blurred.
Yeah, please blur my birthday and the identification number. Thank you. But the point is, that entitled me to possess the cannabis that I bought from that company. Didn't allow me to possess other cannabis, and it allowed me to use that cannabis. What it didn't allow me to do was share it. So I had to say no to any of my colleagues that were curious. But the point was, I wasn't going to hide this because I was allowed to. And you know what was very interesting? Is by taking that position, it contributed to my professional success because a lot of my clients appreciated that perspective. They appreciated that attitude. And what was fascinating, and I live in Calgary. I work in Calgary. It's an extremely conservative city. Well, at least in certain respects, in the traditional respects, it's conservative. And it was interesting to have lawyers who'd been practicing since the 80s or 90s come to my office and talk to me about which of these companies they should buy from if they got medical access. So it was very interesting how, you know, on the surface and at the official level, it had to be sort of discouraged. Although at the end of the day, if someone has the right to use something medically, they just have that right. You can't really limit that, right? And so discouraged, but, you know, if you insisted, they couldn't really stop you. But what was interesting was how on a one-to-one level, the only people who actually interfaced with me were people that supported it and wanted the same thing for themselves. The people who were strongly opposed to it really weren't going to engage with me on a one-to-one level. And that's fine because I'm not here. I'm here only to change minds by example, not by coercion. So if you see what's going on and you think it's fine, then that will change your perspective based on the card you drew earlier. But I'm not going to run around telling people what they should or shouldn't do. You got to live your own life.
Yeah. So how did you have a focus on cannabis and psychedelics then, or did that shift after you kind of?
Well, it took some time. I got medical access, and the amount of time that passed between me getting medical access and deciding to put 100% of my career efforts into it, it was probably more than 24, but less than 48 hours. It was probably about, so it took about that long for me to realize, my goodness, I like cannabis more than I like oil and gas. I'm in Calgary. One of the biggest producers in the country is right there. This is what I'm going to do now. And that actually, like I mentioned earlier, led to essentially all of my success at BLG was because of cannabis. Because out of 750 lawyers, we had a few, we had a handful that were working in capital markets in it, and they're very good at what they do. They're excellent capital markets lawyers, but they weren't really focusing on cannabis itself. Like not the way I was, because not only was I a patient and buying it and participating in the system, I made my entire focus understanding the regulations, understanding the supply chain, understanding the restrictions and the authorizations that allow these products to be sold safely, and just appreciating the products for what they were and where they were going, right? Yeah. I mean, I was sent to my first cannabis trade show in 2016. It was the NCIA, I'm blanking on the acronym, National Cannabis Industry Association meeting in Oakland. Blew my mind. I the first time I ever saw a vape pen, the first time I ever saw a regulated edible, the first time I ever saw at least 200 people openly smoking with uniformed police officers watching them. It was in a hotel, on a balcony, but on hotel property. Couldn't believe this was happening. And then I thought, well, in Canada, it's already federally regulated. Like there is no state, federal, it's just, it's legal or it's not. And nowadays, it's legal for everybody. When I first got involved, it was legal for whoever had a medical document. And it was interesting to tell Americans that in Canada, all my cannabis came in the mail. That was really disconnected from the American way of looking at it. I was allowed to fly domestically with cannabis, and I had some very interesting discussions with law enforcement at the airport, usually asking me why I needed so many different containers for a 4-day business trip. And I said, I know what you're thinking. I'm not diverting in either direction. I simply like variety. And then there was a bit of a pause, and then they said, okay, board your plane. But welcome to 2017. But the other thing was that in Canada at the time, there were two products: a tincture or dried flower. That's it. Yeah. So that was when Americans I spoke with quickly became disappointed. They were enticed by the idea of federal regulation and by the idea that I could fly domestically with it, but were alarmed that Canada at the time in 2017 and 16 only had two product categories. That was viewed as a bit of a retrograde. But I think it's important to appreciate that when something's regulated federally, it's just going to be slower and more deliberate.
Yeah.
And I think that's why in Canada, we only saw those two product formats for the first year. I should say classes. I don't like the word format. Classes of cannabis. For the first year of our adult use regulated market, you could only purchase dried cannabis or cannabis oil. You also could purchase plants or seeds. And there's a category called fresh cannabis that I've never seen commercialized, which I guess just means flowers that have not been dried yet. But
why would you want that?
It's more
experience enough.
Yeah, no, it well, me neither. I have never had a need for that, but I guess it's more of a business to business thing, right? You transfer stuff when it's not per se dried. It's more to identify a component of the supply chain than it is to be a consumer packaged good. But the regulations allow it. If you were able to make it stable, like I think it would rot in the container.
Yeah,
but if you are somehow able to sell, I'm sure as regulations loosen up, and maybe if at some point it is possible to just juice cannabis and drink THCA, maybe something like that'll work out. But I'm not commenting on where provincial or federal legislation will go there.
Interesting.
But
I could see if you dry it in a place that's different from where you grow it and you need authorization to transport it as something that is not dried yet from point A to point B. That might be an interesting classification.
Well, we're more inside the same factory, really.
Oh, it's within the same factory.
Well, probably. I mean, just moving around lots of fresh cannabis is going to be challenging, like just practically challenging to maintain its quality. But I mean, I'm assuming, like a lot of live resins are flash frozen with liquid nitrogen before they're extracted, usually with a hydrocarbon.
Mm.
And that changes the flavor. That makes it a different product than other products. So that kind of approach requires fresh cannabis, at least on my understanding. I'm sure there's all kinds of people, especially on the West Coast, that are very upset with what I just said. I'm sure I have it wrong somewhere, but that's my understanding.
Well, that's fine. It's all good. I know more about psychedelics and their production than cannabis. I've only experienced cannabis dried, and it's legal here in Washington. Yeah. So, which is kind of funny because I visited Copenhagen once, and they've got this place called Pusher Street in Copenhagen, which reminds you why. It's nice to have legal options here in Washington, because you go to Pusher Street and you've got all those weird dudes that are, pulling something out of a bag and are trying to sell it to you. And you're like, I don't want to buy from this person. They don't have a lot of variety, one thing. And I don't feel compelled. Like, how do I trust them? Like, there's no, regulation or anything. And so the funny thing is, when I was there, there was a police raid that happened at the same time as I was there, which apparently it's a frequent thing. And all those guys, basically threw their cannabis products in their bags, threw the bags over the fence, ran down the street to run away from the cops. And, I was like, well, the last thing I want to do is run, because, I'm not selling any cannabis. So I just walked, and I walked to the nearest train station. And of course, that's where all those guys had gone, nearest train station. And there were like two policemen there with like dogs sniffing everybody, like walking by. And they were looking at me, and I was dressed kind of like one of those guys. I was all wearing black. Mm. I was like, oh, shit. I'm hoping the dogs don't jump on me just because I look weird. And you know, the, I started looking at the map on the wall, and I could feel the dog like behind me, like sniffing me. And I was like, I'm just going to keep looking at the map until the dog is done sniffing me. Of course, I probably smelled a little bit like cannabis because I just walked through that street where everybody was smoking weed. But the dog, you know, like let his guards go and went after the two other guys who had been in that street selling stuff. So it makes you appreciate what we have when it's, it's legalized. And, you know, like, I don't see the stores here being crowded with tons of people buying weeds all the time. It's like, you know, it's just like a normal, there's probably less store in the less people in the cannabis store than in the liquor store.
That's what statistics and revenue suggest. And and I mean, we live in a society where you can have cigarettes, you can have donuts, you can have Netflix, you can have all the other stuff on the internet. You know, it's you can abuse anything.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, we could get started on a whole other conversation. I do want to bring it back to leadership, though, and a few nuggets along the way that you've learned and you'd want to share with the leaders out there. Like, what are some of the big insights you gained from psychedelics, cannabis, from your spiritual journey that you say, well, this is what it gave me from a leadership perspective?
Well, I think we'll bring it back to your Magic the Gathering card, right? Perspective, right? I mean, what else is leadership? It's you need to be able to look past yourself. Otherwise, you're just a tyrant, right?
Yeah.
And that is a system that works, you know, in certain contexts, not contexts I want to be involved in. But, you know, that's let's say in its most basic form, telling people what to do is kind of the least sophisticated version of a leader. But I think the best version of a leader is someone who's able to step outside their own immediate needs, instincts, and benefits, think about what it is they're trying to lead, whether that's a country, an organization, a military or police squad, people in a fire truck. I'm thinking of emergency responders a lot here because those are kind of high stakes situations, but a teacher in a classroom is a leader. Student body council member is a leader. And I think perspective is the thing that really separates an effective leader from an ineffective one. Because if you can't understand the motivations behind the people you're leading, and you can't understand the motivations of the thing you're leading them in the name of, then you're not a leader. So, and I have to think that psychedelics used with intent, used the what some people might call the correct way. I mean, maybe the Aztecs would disagree, but the use the way some people would call the correct way is something that will make you more empathetic and understand other people's needs and their perspectives and their fears and help you relate to them better, which if you can just make that last leap will help you lead them better. So I think that, and it doesn't have to be drugs, but the experience that you can get through meditation, through breath work, and I think just through really taking engagement in a task that is probably the same neurochemistry phenomenon that we're getting a shortcut to with some psychedelics used in certain ways. Because, again, I think if you use them enough, it just kind of blurs everything out, I think. You know, never commenting on anything I've done or not done, again, respect the law, but I have to think that these states of mind, and I'm sure Albert Hoffman or Steve Jobs would agree, just give you an insight that's very difficult to get other ways and certainly perhaps impossible to get with a comparable level of time investment, i.e. nothing one day, right? I think it just helps you approach life in a more informed way. And I think contributes to your perspective, and I think makes you a better leader. That was a bit circular, definitely a bit foofy, but made sense to me.
This makes a lot of sense. This is magical. Here's, you know, it's funny. So I'm going to show this post-it. This is not you know, rigged or anything. So this post-it here, it was the answer to the question you filled out that there's a form I asked, and yeah. It says perspective and gratitude. Now, that post-it was on my screen today, earlier, because I like to have those on my screen when I meet with a guest. And that was before I actually pulled the card that said perspective on it. So I'm like, wow, that's pretty neat. You know, I could have pulled the gratitude card too, but I didn't even know I had a card that said perspective in the deck.
Putting the magic back in Magic the Gathering. I've never played it, by the way. I just know it's a card game.
You know, I've tried to play it with my kids, and there's just so many rules that drove me crazy. But I'm just like, I, and they felt like they were changing all the time. They're like, Dad, it's easy. Anyway, perspective, really important. Last question, essence of leadership. And I love your answer because it echoes actually multiple times across multiple guests. Do you remember what you said for capturing the essence of leadership?
I do not.
Mycelium network, mycelial.
Oh, yeah. You wanted me to compare it to a plant or, yes.
Yeah.
Well, in this case,
a
fungus.
An animal. Yeah.
Yeah. I think a mycelial network, which is, you know, fungi, it just, and I'm basically doing a terrible job of paraphrasing the Paul Stamets Netflix documentary, but
fantastic fungi.
Yes, I mean, he's a leading expert for a reason, and the comments from him and from Dennis McKenna in that, I think, said it best. Like, just there's a contact between different elements of the environment that mycelia have, and there's communication among them, and it's a mycelial network is essentially. It can't really be separated from its environment, can it? Like once it's, I mean, you could have mycelia in a jar and you can culture them in pure form, and the number of companies are doing that, but it can be, once it's part of a natural network, I'd say much like humans, it can't really be separated from that. Like you can try, but the impact of sharing a life with that network, all the other things that the mycelia is touching, you can't ever really reverse that. And whatever course it takes going forward will be impacted by where it came from. And I think a good leader is the same way. And then bringing it back to just the understanding of by connection with your environment. And I mean, whatever your environment may be, inside your office with your coworkers, I don't mean the environment at large, although that too, that would be included in that definition. That's just so important for living your best life in general, including but not limited to as a leader, right?
Yeah. Beautiful. It's all entwined, all connected. And then you get that perspective as well as you're aware of that context and environment. And there's a lot of leaders that distance themselves from the environment. I think especially, you know, when they start getting paid insane salaries, they're kind of in their crystal tower there. And so I like that sense of mycelium network, and everybody explains it differently. So I really need to write a paper about like everybody's answer on this one, because several guests from Guela, actually, I don't know if you're familiar with the company Guela Mushrooms in Toronto, but they do the mojo gummy and so on. They all answered individually without knowing each other's answer, mycelium network. So it was interesting. Very different reasons than what you provided. And so it just adds to the reason. So it's beautiful. You know, we're wrapping this up now. Is there any other questions you wish I had asked you, or things you wish we had covered, or you want to save that for the next time we meet?
No, I certainly, we hope we do meet in person at some point. I really hope you're able to come to Calgary. We can show you what SciGen looks like. And it's, no, I mean, I,
good.
I hope there's a next time, and I didn't really have bullet points for this.
Oh, great. Awesome. Where can people find you? I'll put that in the show notes, but is there like an easy way for people to find you and your company?
So PsyGen, that's PSYGEN.ca. It's a Canadian company. We manufacture active pharmaceutical ingredients. We're a licensed dealer. We manufacture psychedelics for clinical trials. And we're very proud of what we do. So you can just kind of, if you really want to get through to me personally, the PsyGen website has a portal where you can just ask whatever you want. Also easy to find on LinkedIn. That is the only social media platform I use. I'm sure Microsoft would be very proud of me. And then my personal legal practice is R Group Legal. It is just me. It's a chemistry metaphor. There is no other lawyers. I'm very clear about that on my website. And that's david@rgrouplegal.com, spelt just how it sounds.
Great. Well, I'll put in the notes as well so people can get it right. Good. Well, David, it was a pleasure to chat today. I learned a lot, and I'm sure people listening or watching really enjoyed it and learned a lot as well. So thank you.
And thank you. Have a great day.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. If you like the show, please subscribe to it on Apple Podcasts, follow me on Instagram at leadershipadelics, or stop by my website and say hi at fouyad.com. That's F-O-O-Y-A-D. There's a lot going on. I've got a retreat coming up in October. I've got Flute Fridays. And I'd love to hear from you all, the listeners that tune in every week. And if you have suggestions for future guests, don't hesitate to reach out. I'm there, and I'd love to get more guests on the show. Thank you. Have a great day.